This week on Life and Faith.
My diagnosis for it is that we've kind of reached a bit of a tipping point in our culture where I think the secular story of reality is kind of running out of steam for people.
If something happens at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, you're at work.
She had saved my life and I felt as if she was around me that I was going to live.
You can't just condemn everything that doesn't play by your rules.
None of those who are present raised their hand.
Welcome to Life and Faith from CPX. I'm Simon Smart. Well, for decades now in the West, religion has been on the retreat. In places where 50 years ago, going to church on a Sunday was just what you did, we've had generations now for whom that would be a very foreign concept. Australia is no different to other similar countries. In the last census, 43.9% of Australians tick the Christian box, and that was down from 52% the time before. The no religion category is on a sharp rise at 38.9%. Only around 15% of us go to church once a month. Some churches are booming, but there are plenty that are a mere shadow of their former glory days. My guest today is from the UK, where those figures reflecting the move away from adherence to the Christian faith are even more pronounced. Of course, Christianity is booming in other parts of the world, like Africa and Asia and Latin America. But it's fair to ask, will this pattern in the Western world continue in the same direction? Historians point out that Christian faith, over and over again, seems to defy the odds and keeps on being reborn and reshaped, never seeming to die out. Justin Brierley is an author and very popular podcaster. For 17 years, he hosted a podcast called Unbelievable, where he would bring together atheist and Christian thinkers for robust but civil discussion. And he presided over conversations with some of the world's great minds for these dialogues and modelled a brilliant way to disagree productively. And that in itself is a great gift. He's just published a book called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God, and he has a podcast with the same name. Justin Brierley detects a shift in the air. Is this his imagination, or might there be something to this? I spoke to him from his home in the UK. In his book, he says that the thoroughly secular vision of the world is starting to feel a bit threadbare. So I asked him, what are the key things that are missing from the secular story?
I think there are three key things missing: meaning, purpose, and identity. Because I think the secular story that has kind of crept in and is sort of the background hum in many ways of our culture now, well, it's not even a story, it's a non-story. It's something that says you are part of a meaningless, purposeless process. You are here purely by chance. And any meaning you can have in your life is sort of transitory and, you know, essentially something that you invent for yourself. And I think that has all kinds of ramifications because ultimately it means we've got no agency really over our life, our destiny, our future. And I think there's a real sense in which our identity is completely up for grabs in that story as well. There's no givenness to life. There's no sense of what we're made for or who we're supposed to be. And so I think that's coming out in our culture in all kinds of interesting ways, quite destructive ways in some ways. And so I think the problem is that we're kind of living in this dualistic culture where on the one hand, this is the story of reality that we're being told, that we live in this sort of meaningless, purposeless cosmos. It's essentially a clockwork machine. On the other hand, we still are living on the embers of our Christian past. So that story still actually informs a lot of our fundamental moral instincts. And I think we're getting to a point, though, where people are starting to realize that you can't put these two worlds together. Mm. It has to be one or the other. And that the secular materialist story of reality can't support the things that the West took for granted for a long time from the Christian story, like meaning, purpose, and identity, because those things were specifically shaped by the Christian story and the shape, as you say, that it gave to people's lives. So again, I think there are all kinds of symptoms of this. I think, you know, what some psychologists have deemed the meaning crisis is all a part of this, the rise in mental health issues, anxiety, depression, suicide, the fact that we're constantly distracted, we can't kind of concentrate on anything, that technology is kind of as much a curse as it is a blessing in our lives. All of this, I think, are symptoms of this fact that we're losing the Christian story and it's being replaced by this story which doesn't contain meaning, doesn't contain purpose, and where identity is purely something you invent for yourself.
Yeah, there's a way in which embracing that secular story offers you, appears to offer you at least, a whole lot of freedom. I mean, you're not tied to anything. And yet we're finding that it's kind of not working for people. That's a sense you have, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just to use a very simple analogy, if you go and play a game of football, you'll play a far better game of football when there's a referee enforcing the rules of the game. If everyone's just free to play the game exactly how they want, you'll have a terrible game of football. And it's like that in life. Freedom, on the face of it, sounds great in principle, but actually it only works when it's within certain parameters. Pure freedom is actually anarchy, essentially. It doesn't actually give people flourishing lives. And I think that's very often the way people have viewed the Christian story, you know, especially in a kind of post-Christian West, as a sort of, oh, it's just about rules and regulations and so on. And it's this thing we want to shed so that we can become free. I think what people are now starting to realize, as the story genuinely is starting to slide away in the back mirror, is that, it turns out pure freedom does not buy you a meaningful life, because there are certain ways, it turns out, that we've kind of shaped ourselves to live meaningful kind of rules, patterns that do actually help us to live better, more flourishing lives, more free lives, ironically, than where simply this kind of very blanket kind of freedom is imposed, which sort of seeks to free itself from any kind of commitments, relationships, forms of community and everything else. That's when I think you have a problem.
Yeah, there are signs that that hasn't worked very well for us. Now, the image you use in your book, it's kind of all the way through, is one of the tide of faith that's reached a very low tide. It comes from the 19th century Matthew Arnold poem, Dover Beach. It talks about the sea of faith, once full or perhaps high, now exhibiting, and quoting him here, melancholy long withdrawing roar. It's a great line, isn't it? Now, that sea of faith, though, has been a long way out for a long time, it would seem. But your sense is that perhaps it's on the way back. So what makes you feel like that?
Well, there's a few different things, and these are some of the big themes I try to sketch out in the book. One of them is simply something I've noticed in my own lifetime and my career working as someone bringing Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. And my attempts to do that through a show called Unbelievable really began in around the mid-2000s, just at the time when the new atheism was getting going, that new atheism being this very sort of dogmatic, anti-theistic form of atheism, and led by people like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and so on, the so-called four horsemen of the new atheism. And what I noticed simply is that over the years, that very dogmatic, shrill form of atheism seems to have gone out of fashion. It, I think, kind of collapsed in on itself for all kinds of interesting reasons I go into in the book. But I think also people just sort of started to recognize it. It was itself a sort of slightly fundamentalist, zealous version of religion, just a kind of one without God. And what I've noticed as that has sort of faded is that people have just started to be a lot more open to the concept of God again, especially talking about the value of Christianity, whereas Christianity was just completely dismissed as irrelevant and evil by the new atheists. I think you're seeing a whole new set of secular thinkers who aren't necessarily Christians, but who are occupying very popular public stages and talking in very sympathetic terms, actually, about the value of Christianity. I think these are people who are recognizing what I mentioned earlier, the meaning crisis, and realizing that the West is actually essentially built on Christian assumptions. So you could talk about Jordan Peterson, the well-known psychologist. You could talk about Tom Holland, a popular historian whose book Dominion really makes the case for the way all our moral instincts have been shaped by the West. Douglas Murray, a well-known journalist here in the UK, you know, who was very much a friend and confidant of the new atheists in its heyday, but now realizes that it just couldn't carry the weight of the questions and the meaning that people need in their lives, and now refers to himself as a Christian atheist, just because he recognizes how baked in the Christian assumptions are that he holds, even as he doesn't believe necessarily in God or Christianity. So this was interesting me. I was meeting more and more of these people who were kind of having these much more sympathetic conversations about God. And at the same time, I was noticing that the culture itself just felt like we were starting to splinter. My diagnosis for it is that we've kind of reached a bit of a tipping point in our culture where I think the secular story of reality is kind of running out of steam for people. And to the extent that we're still going, it's because we're still running on the dregs of the Christianity that still sort of existed at an underlying level in our culture. And then I was also meeting people who were very surprising adult converts to Christianity. Now, I'm not saying this is some sort of huge demographic swing, but there were enough interesting stories that made me think there's quite a lot of people out there who are kind of willing to change their mind, actually. People that you would have just absolutely assumed were your secular, liberal, atheist types who actually have embraced Christianity in quite surprising circumstances. And for me, it felt like we might just be starting to see a turning of that tide, that Matthew Arnold Dover Beach tide, that yes, it's currently, you know, we all know what direction in the West the statistics are going on church and religious affiliation and everything else. But sometimes something's changing in the atmosphere and you only feel it downstream sometime later. And I just feel we're in one of those moments where that tide might be turning and ready to come back in again.
Yeah, I was interested in that because if you looked at it from a purely the stats and where people are at and the no religion category sort of growing rapidly every year, people identifying in even in a nominal way as Christian in your country and ours has sort of fallen off a cliff really. But yeah, I was fascinated by your sense of it. Is it because you're talking to people who at one level are quite influential people or come from kind of influential groups of people who you think might start to influence the culture in the way that you're describing, or is it something other than that?
I think it's a combination of things. I think these are quite influential people. You know, Jordan Peterson, whatever you think of him, he's got a huge platform. You know, he sells out auditoriums. I went to see him speaking for a couple of hours at the O2 in London a few months ago with my son, with about 13,000 people in attendance. Now, that's interesting because what's he talking about? He's talking about God, basically. He's pointing people back to the scriptures. Now, he's an interesting person because it's a bit hard to nail down exactly where he stands on the kind of historical truth of Christianity, but he certainly is talking in very Christian-sounding terms to a lot of people. This is a largely non-Christian audience. And again, you know, you're seeing millions of people following his podcast. I meet so many people, especially young men, who are talking about the way they're now thinking about faith in a completely different way because of Jordan Peterson. Now, again, that is obviously a specific demographic, and I'm not saying that this is across the board.
Yeah.
But then you multiply that with some of these other folk I've mentioned who, again, are just willing to take public stages and are talking in very different terms to the new atheist, certainly, about the value of Christianity. And it does feel like something's changing in that way. People who have reviewed my book and listened to my new podcast documentary series on this have raised an important question, which is this just a sort of socially conservative kind of set of people who are kind of wanting a return to the sort of orthodoxy and conservative values, essentially, of Christianity? And I think there is a danger of that. One particular example comes to mind who caused quite a lot of stir when she announced that she had embraced Christianity recently, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Yeah. Who is this Somali-born Dutch former New Atheist. She was very much part of the New Atheist.
She was a bit of a darling of that group, wasn't she?
She was, yeah. Oh. Her thing was having come out of fundamentalist Islam. She was very much critical of that, continues to be, and kind of fell in with the New Atheist, kind of dismissing religion and God altogether as evil and pernicious and so on. But she's had a dramatic change of heart in the last few years. And what she wrote in this viral essay for Unheard about her change of mind was that she just recognized that atheism cannot provide the kind of meaning and purpose and identity that people need in their lives and cannot provide the kind of bulwark that's needed against other very big threats, you know, whether it be Islamism or Putin or what she sees as, you know, woke ideologies on the left. And a lot of people were very concerned and understandably that, oh, she's just sort of embracing Christianity for these purely political, cultural reasons. And arguably, yes, that is part of her motivation. But actually, if you read the essay and listen to some of the interviews she's done, there's obviously a spiritual dimension to this. She talks about having been in this sort of spiritually bankrupt place and realizing that she basically needed something like Jesus. Now, where she is on the journey, I couldn't tell you. But I suppose just coming back to the point is this just a socially conservative thing? Well, at one level, yes, it's happening in those circles. But I think they're recognizing something that's a bit deeper than just politics. It's that they're realizing things are coming apart. And I think people on the left are realizing that as well. You know, I've listened to some fascinating people who are kind of more left-leaning, who are also recognizing that the atheist secular kind of narrative cannot support the kind of meaning people need. So I think there is something going on. You know, I'm not saying that this is reflected in the bigger sort of statistics, but I feel like it's significant enough. The germ for this idea of this book came back in, I don't know, 2020, I think. And then I sort of got really writing it in 2021, 2022, finally got published, you know, last year in 2023. But just around the time it got published, suddenly it felt like there was a wave of other people basically saying similar things. This story of Ayaan Hirsi Ali came out shortly after it got published. Yeah. And it just feels like, no, I don't think I'm just imagining this. I think there's genuinely something happening here in the culture at the moment.
You're listening to Life and Faith, and I'm speaking with Justin Brierley. His new book is called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. Now, you may recall, if you're an avid Life and Faith listener, that we had the author and theologian Stephen Garber on the podcast a few years ago, and he made the observation that when it comes to recognizing the currents of our culture and the things that are influencing us, and these were his words, the artists get there first. Well, I put this to Justin Brierley, that I'm noticing that so many themes in contemporary literature today and some of the best writing are theological themes, and whether or not he had noticed the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, you could go even just to the really popular forms of entertainment, you know, the blockbuster movies, the Harry Potters, you know, you don't have to dig very far to find extremely Christian motifs. Perhaps that's completely unsurprising because, as I say, we are living in, you know, still on the embers of this Christian story. And fundamentally, that's the story that shapes us. It's the story that actually I think our hearts kind of bend towards inevitably. I mean, I think people have tried in the West, you know, a very postmodern take on everything. But I think that that doesn't sustain people for very long. It's nice to be avant-garde, but ultimately people still want good to triumph over evil. People still believe this idea that sacrifice of the strongest for the weak is somehow important and central. And that idea has kind of been baked in so strongly that it's still quite hard to get rid of. And you'll still find it popping up in literature, movies, everything else. I mean, speaking of artists, one of your own countrymen, Nick Cave, is quite an interesting example here. Who published this memoir recently, Hope, Faith and Carnage. Again, reading that memoir, hearing what he's been saying, it's just another fascinating example of someone who you couldn't exactly pigeonhole as a sort of evangelical Christian by any stretch, but he's obviously feeling something very deeply about the Christian story that for him is resonating in all kinds of ways. And it's almost like, you know, he had to go through his rebellious punk casting off the shackles of everything stage, but it's like the story was waiting for him, you know, on the other side. And I just feel like it might be like that for a lot of people. They've kind of had to go through almost their the new atheism feels like it was almost like the teenage atheist phase for a lot of people. And I just wonder how many people are now kind of starting to come out of that on the other side and find actually there's something much deeper and richer here that I missed the first time around.
Well, the Nick Cave story that emerges out of terrible grief too, and perhaps collectively the thing you're describing of Western culture might have some, you know, similar resonances.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was very moved by the book that he wrote. And it is just one of those facts that in our world, it often is awful tragedies, grief that tends to actually move us in the direction of God. Now, obviously, for some people, it sends them spinning away. But in his case, it feels like it's been a catalyst for diving deeper into sort of the mystery of reality. I almost wonder in a kind of wider sense whether that's true at a wider cultural level as well. Because I think we're living in quite sort of apocalyptic times, it often feels like, you know, with the rise of AI, the threat of war in Europe, there's all kinds of like things that kind of people, I think, were lulled into a false sense of security that, oh, you know, we're just happily trundling along and things will just continue to get better. And suddenly we find ourselves in a sort of place where like, oh, maybe it's not all going to get better. The interesting thing is, of course, that it's often those moments that suddenly faith comes back. You know, there's some interesting research done about what World War One and World War Two did in Europe, which was already on a very kind of a path towards steep secularization, even at that point. But there was this real blip after World War Two and World War One, where suddenly people like C.S. Lewis were able to speak into a culture that were kind of needed to hear this idea that there's a God behind it all. And again, I just wonder whether we're maybe heading for one of those moments, whether this will kind of turn the tide completely on secularism, I don't know. But I do feel like it's often those moments that actually do send people back towards God in that way.
Yeah, you mentioned in your book the culturally incredible moment when the Queen died and the kind of way in which people were looking for both ceremony and symbol and ways to express something quite profound in their loss, and were reaching for a kind of religious language that they might have lost along the way, but they're kind of searching for that language. And I wonder if there's a role to play in kind of giving people a language that they can live into, that starts to, they can inhabit in a way. Because it seems to me that represents things that we long for. We long for things to have eternal significance. We long for where to sort of situate our longings, I guess.
I think, in all honesty, this is something that parts of the church could really do with learning, that sometimes there's been a focus in terms of trying to put Christianity across to a largely secular culture of just sort of trying to give people facts, basically. You know, here's 10 reasons you should believe in God, 5 evidences for the resurrection. And there's a place for that. But actually, the first place that you tend to reach people is actually, as you've said, in that place of finding a place to put your feelings and emotions and a carrier for that. The church historically has been the place that people have done that, you know, whether they fully understood it or not at a kind of intellectual level. It was a way of taking the big moments of life and putting them in a sacred space and investing them with meaning, whether that be birth or marriage or death or any of the other sort of markers of life.
Yes.
And I think people still want that. People still sense the need to kind of put these things into a kind of a special category. And, you know, I think we're still at the point where church, for a lot of people, even if they don't think of themselves as Christian, can still feel like a way of doing that. I think the church sometimes in that sense needs to sort of lean into that and not try to always immediately explain everything, but just let people feel the sense of mystery. Speaking of Nick Cave and Tom Holland and some of those interesting people who are on this journey, you know, they're obviously highly intellectual people. But in my interactions with them, when they are leaning into Christianity, it's at a more kind of emotional aesthetic level. Yeah. It's about finding a place where they can feel like they're connected to something that is bigger than them, that's rooted in an ancient set of words and liturgy. You know, I know that when Nick Cave does go to church, he's looking for something like that, a kind of otherworldly experience, not just a sort of set of propositions about belief, if you like. So I just think there is something about that. It's about speaking to people's imagination and the heart as much as it is about speaking to their mind and their intellect in that way.
Yeah, you mentioned mystery. I think, and you say this in your book, and it touches on this sort of disenchantment of the world that a thoroughly secular viewpoint tends to have, or has, necessarily has. And yet people, you know, they reach for it, don't they? They reach for transcendence and wonder and beauty.
They do. I think the danger is sometimes certain Christians, myself included, try to want to immediately leap from that to, you know, the sort of factual historical stuff.
Yeah.
When I think actually it's fine to kind of let people live in that place for a while because that's where it's striking them. I do see this in a lot of the conversations I'm having with people who are sort of somewhere in that hinterland, that in-between place of, they've become fairly convinced intellectually that the sort of secular materialist sort of vision of reality is flawed. It can't sustain a meaningful life. But they find themselves sort of on the edge of a precipice because they feel like there's also this massive leap of faith they have to take if they were to commit themselves to something like Christianity. And so many of the people I've spoken to, you know, for this new documentary series on the surprising rebirth of belief in God and in the book are kind of somewhere in that place. But they know that there's something they're connecting with when they do walk into an old church or pray, even if they're not sure what they're praying to. And I think it's okay in some ways to say that's where that person is and you can't kind of necessarily hurry them on to some next stage. My hope and prayer is that those of us who perhaps have gone the next stage would be able to help people see that all of those longings are pointing towards something real. You know, as C.S. Lewis famously said, what if the fact that we have these desires, and if every other desire we have seems to be able to be satisfied, you know, a duckling wants to swim, there is such a thing as water, people feel hunger, there's such a thing as food. What if these desires mean that we were made for another world? And I just feel like there's a way of showing people that those desires all do ultimately converge in the person of Jesus Christ. And it's as much about sort of being able to shed the assumptions of the secular materialist culture that completely infuse us in our modern age, to be able to kind of step into a sort of new story of reality. But I do think it happens. You know, I see people do it. And so, yeah, I'm hopeful that the church can find a way of putting that across to people that acknowledges this deeply sort of transcendent, mysterious sort of side of their personality that seems to be coming through.
You talk in the book a little bit about some famous reluctant converts. I mean, C.S. Lewis, of course, himself described himself as that. You mentioned Paul Kingsnorth, and T.S. Eliot might have had a similar kind of feeling. You've talked to so many people who were converts or have been over the years. What are the ones you personally were most moved by the story?
There are a lot that I could choose from. I really love the story of Francis Spufford.
Yeah.
He wrote a fantastic book a few years ago called Unapologetic: Why, Despite Everything, Christianity Can Still Make Surprising Emotional Sense. A very long subtitle.
Yes.
You know, he sort of grew up in a sort of Anglican Christian environment, but basically rejected it in his teenage years and spent about 20 years really as an atheist. And he talks quite movingly in that book about he got to a point in his life as a married man where he doesn't sort of give the details, but there was some kind of a crisis. And he just talks very movingly about the way that the grace of Christianity just crept back in a very sort of subconscious way, almost through a piece of music that he was listening to in a cafe while nursing the headache of what had happened the night before over a cappuccino. And just this sense that God was waiting for him. And I just sense that that's kind of often people's experience. And I think the reason I call it the surprising rebirth of belief in God is not just because it would be very surprising, wouldn't it, if we saw a return to God in our generation. But people always describe themselves as completely surprised because they hadn't expected this to be the answer. You know, Paul Kingsnorth is another good example of that. This sort of celebrated author and poet here in the UK who went through all kinds of interesting periods of his life. He's been a sort of environmental activist, went on to become a novelist, poet, writer, but sort of had a period of sort of teenage atheism, then a long spell in Buddhism, still was looking for something to worship, though. He had this strong sense that nature was enchanted at some level. He couldn't sort of reconcile himself to his, you know, it all ultimately being meaningless. And he tried Wicca, nature worship in the woods, which he discovered in the end was just a sort of pastiche of Christian heresies and neo-pagan stuff. But out of the blue, his wife over dinner, not a Christian herself, tells him, "You're going to become a Christian." And he says, what are you talking about? But then he starts getting all kinds of people coming out of the woodwork that he didn't realize were Christians, who were Christians, sort of talking to him. And then he starts having dreams about Jesus. And to his great surprise, he finds himself becoming a Christian. There's another person whose story I don't tell in the book, but is coming up on a podcast edition of the show soon. Molly Worthen, professor of history of religion in North Carolina, an agnostic all her life, had been reporting, you know, as a journalist on the good, the bad and the ugly of North American Christianity for many years. Plenty of material to work with. Every reason to reject religion. And yet she got baptized in the summer of 2022. And it's because she just stumbled through actually a piece she was doing about a megachurch pastor in her neck of the woods who just took the time to engage with her over email about the evidence for Jesus, put her in touch with N.T. Wright and Tim Keller at the time to kind of ask some of her questions of. And she just found there was something here that made historical sense and made sense of her as well. And again, this was not the plan, you know, as far as she was concerned. So again, I just find it really interesting that even in our modern skeptical age, you can have people who go on these journeys, thinking, intelligent people. And it suggests to me that, yeah, it happens. It can happen. It does happen. And I think that's quite interesting and perhaps a sign of what might happen even on a larger scale going forward.
Now, you want to stress that the Christian story is metaphorically powerful, as you say, more people seem to be acknowledging. But at the end of the day, you say it's only that if it's true. Now, the claims of Christianity are pretty wild, but I wonder if you feel like they've been tamed in people's minds these days, and that might be a factor in people's kind of apathy. Because you talked about the new atheism that's kind of faded away, but apathy, at least in this country, seems to be a big part of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's a bit like when you get inoculated against a disease or virus, isn't it? They give you just enough of the thing to kind of create the antibodies in you to defend off the real thing when it comes along. And I feel a bit like that, certainly here in post-Christian Britain. People think they know what religion is, what Christianity is, because they've maybe went to Sunday school or sang a few hymns in their school assembly or whatever. And it's inoculated them against the real thing in that sense. And I think part of the apathy is because people think that, oh, well, I've seen that. That's definitely not the thing. I wonder maybe whether that's changing, because in some sense, I almost wonder whether you do need to have a complete kind of sweeping away of even the cultural nominal Christianity for the real thing to be able to kind of come through again. And so I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, actually, that we're going through this time of de-Christianization, because sometimes that cultural Christianity can act as that sort of inoculation against the real thing. I guess I'm optimistic, though, that in the end, whatever it looks like in our little slice of history and time here in the West, there is a bigger purpose at play. You know, I am a Christian and I do believe there's a God behind this bigger story. And for me, when I do look back, you know, historically, there have always been times when it looks like Christianity is, you know, heading for decline and death. And yet there's always some kind of rebirth happens. You know, it's a story of successive tides going out and tides coming back in again. And I just wonder if we're in one of those moments, in a sense, and people do wake up. People wake up to the reality they're living in sometimes, and they realize, actually, this isn't what life is meant to be about. So that's my, I suppose, very simple, possibly naive, but optimistic thesis, is that I think we're due for one of those moments in the West right now.
You've spent many years now bringing together people who see the world very differently into very productive, respectful, friendly conversations on the whole. What's the key to that kind of hospitality?
I think it's about just being open to listening, having genuine conversations, not going in to necessarily win a debate, because I think people take away more from a genuine meeting of minds and conversation than they do from just someone who's there to score points, essentially. I'd say I've grown, in a sense, in confidence in the Christian faith, but there's a good and a bad form of confidence. Sometimes, you know, some people think confidence is about just being able to kind of, as I say, demolish the other person in an argument. I think it's about actually being confident enough in what you believe to be able to just listen to people who don't agree with you without having some knee-jerk response of fear and retaliation. Sadly, that's the way it often plays out in social media, in other forums. It's all about this tribalistic zero-sum game. Yeah. And I just think there's such a need in our culture for people just to be able to sit down and listen to each other and not necessarily answer back, but just to say, hey, that's a really interesting point. I'll go away and have a think about that. And I found that just a really helpful way of doing it. It can be uncomfortable, because sometimes we like feeling like we're absolutely, you know, right, and we're kind of in our silo, and we're in our echo chamber. We like the security that brings. But I think there's something really valuable about stepping outside of that, exposing yourself to other points of view, being genuinely open to that, and just seeing what happens in the process.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. Thanks so much to Justin Brierley. His latest book is The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God: Why New Atheism Grew Old and Secular Thinkers Are Considering Christianity Again. We'll put links to the book and to the podcast of the same name and Justin's website in the show notes. Please share this episode with someone you know, flick it to them on their phone or email them. I'm sure there'd be someone you think might benefit from this conversation. And leave us a rating or review. It helps us to get Life and Faith out to lots more people. And if you'd like to hear more about what we do at CPX, please go to our website at publicchristianity.org and sign up to our fortnightly newsletter. And thanks, as always, to our producer, Alan Douthwaite, who is...
just another fascinating example of someone who you couldn't exactly pigeonhole by any stretch, but he's obviously feeling something very deeply about the Christian story that for him is resonating in all kinds of ways.
Next week.
We say in intensive care, people die many deaths, and it's not just biological death, but it's death of dignity, death of independence, or even a sense of self. And so as a chaplain, we come into that space just by simply listening to them and saying, I am seeing you, I hear you, not as a patient, but as a person. Just for that moment, I can just sit with them as a human to human.